This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you're a teacher, a school administrator, or a parent, you may have a problem most others don't realize. Someone's always trying to sell you on a different way of teaching. Switch to this approach and your kids' abilities in reading and math and science will absolutely soar. The sales pitch often includes the phrase, "The latest scientific research now shows." But how do you know? When it comes to the science of medicine or drugs or even highway construction, there are national organizations that monitor best practices, but when it comes to the science of education, not so much. Psychologist Dan Willingham thinks it's time we did have a nationwide authority on education research, but until then, he has some ideas on how the rest of us can sort out the fluff from the good stuff. Ideas that might actually apply to all kinds of sales pitches, not just those in education. So Dr. Willingham's new book, When Can You Trust the Experts?, will be our focus right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. If you hear someone say these words, "The latest scientific research shows," what's your reaction? Is there a tendency to give more credibility to a sales pitch if it seems to be based on some aspect of science? Maybe to not even think of it as a sales pitch at all. What if the particular field of science at issue is something you know almost nothing about? Are there still ways to tell if the pitch you're hearing is likely to be valid? Today's guest addresses these and many more related questions in his new book, but we also want to hear your thoughts about when you find claims of good research believable and when you don't. We are coming to you today from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, but our call-in phone line is the same as always, 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. The book is titled, When Can You Trust the Experts? How to Tell Good Science from Bad in Education. Its author is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, Dr. Dan Willingham. Welcome back to the Inside Airwaves.
Thanks so much, Tom. Great to be here.
Well, Dan, is it possible that you have written a book addressing a problem that many people don't even realize exists?
Well, that would explain the sales, but of the book, which have maybe not been as brisk as I would have liked. No, I actually think that there is some appreciation for the fact that there's a problem here. But let me elaborate. I mean, I think people recognize there's a problem because they are frustrated, you know, intermittently frustrated that they hear these claims. It's research based. You know, don't worry about it. Frequently, if you're a parent, you hear this coming from a teacher or administrator. Or you might hear it as part of a sales pitch if you're trying to find an education product for your child. But let me try and put it in a broader context. Education is similar to many other fields in that there is ongoing scientific research that could be applicable to the practice of education. So in that sense, it's similar to medicine. It's similar to architecture. Both of these are applied fields where you've got researchers doing their thing and then practitioners doing their thing. The way in which there's a particular problem in education is that most fields that have this relationship with the basic sciences also have some way of making the latest findings known to practitioners in a way that is reliable. So in other words, if I'm a physician and I go to medical school and I learn all the latest scientific advances for treating patients, when I'm actually out in practice and treating patients, it's not expected that I am going to be reading journal articles every night to keep up with the latest advances. Instead, the field has sort of gotten itself together and taken care of that problem for practitioners. So they see to it that there are periodic summaries that are published for practitioners so that they can know, oh, okay, there's enough of an advance that we now have a different way of treating strep throat or whatever it is. In addition, as sort of a byproduct for that, if you're not a practitioner but you're just a consumer, so you're a patient like you or me, frequently those same organizations that are doing that job for practitioners have something available for consumers, for patients. So if you want to know, what does the scientific community think about homeopathy, for example? There are reliable websites where you can go and get information as to what the best scientists in the field think about that. Education is really different. There is nothing like that to help teachers and help administrators, and certainly nothing like that to help parents. And so that's the problem that I was trying to address in the book. I think ideally those resources would be available for practitioners and for parents, but given that it's not, I wrote this book to try and provide some assistance.
Dr. Dan Willingham, are there settled areas of science when it comes to what works and what doesn't in education?
That's a little complicated because I would say no, but let me add that I think the question's a little more complicated than we would normally think of it. So we have science, and science is a description of the natural world. Then we have things that we want to do with the science, and that inevitably entails goals. So, for example, you can have a settled scientific fact, and what that's going to mean for education could be very different depending on what you want to a child to get out of his or her education. So, for example, an example I give in the book is the nature of intelligence. So what is the structure of the human mind? What is human intellect really like? This is a scientific question. It's something psychologists have been working on for a long time. And there's some agreement that intellect is not a single thing. There are different components. So it's a commonplace observation that some people are good with words, some people are good with numbers. That holds up scientifically. Now, what that means for schooling is not straightforward, right? Because it could be that you would say, well, whatever the different pieces of intellect are, school just ought to address all of them. Another point of view you could take is there's all these different pieces to intellect. It's the school's job to find out what a child is really good at and boost that and not worry about anything else. Or you could say, no, the point of school is to help kids get a job when they get out. And so school should be promoting whatever is going to do them some good in that context. So you can't really say, are there things that we know for sure in an educational sense, because it's all tied up with goals.
And we don't agree on what the goals are?
I think we don't like to talk about the goals because it makes people uncomfortable. It leads to school boards certainly are sort of notoriously shy about sort of laying on the table, here's what we're trying to do. And so if you look at the mission statements of districts or of schools and states have state departments of education and mission statements also, they're inevitably things that nobody could argue with. They're sort of like, we want to enable every child to live a fulfilling life and, you know, grow up to love apple pie, and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's usually sort of not very substantive. But, you know, there are trade-offs. You're inevitably going to, if you're doing some things, you're going to have to leave some other things out. And when you really put your goals on the table, you're making plain what your priorities are. So people who are in charge usually are not too eager to talk about that.
Well, to you on the other side of your radio, Dr. Willingham's book is primarily aimed at how to judge claims of scientific findings on best ways to educate children, although we are also going to be exploring some of his suggested guidelines for beliefs about other areas of science. But let's look specifically at education for at least a few moments. So have you ever heard a sales pitch about a better way to get kids to learn that left you puzzled or skeptical? Have you heard claims about research in education that made perfect sense to you, and you found yourself thinking, those are just the kinds of changes that ought to be made in local classrooms? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us through our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And first up here on Facebook, Dan, is a question I think you're going to love, because from what I recall of your book, I think this touches on maybe the most controversial point that you make. So let me just read Sue's question. She says,
this is a heck of a build-up, I have to say.
What does your guest think of the suggestion that we all have different ways of most effective learning? I was once told that I am a kinesthetic learner. I guess that means I learn best through touch, but I think I remember information better if I hear it first, like on the radio, rather than in reading books or newspapers.
Right. So I guess given where I am, I should say everyone learns best over the radio. That would really be the right answer. So, right. So
you get a lot of grief, though, for what you point out, the science, the reliable science says about this idea of learning styles.
Yes. Learning styles. It's very interesting to me, actually. This is a question. Every year I teach a big course at UVA, Introduction to Cognitive Psychology. Usually it's about 350 students. And I ask my students, do you know about this idea of learning styles? Do you think it's right? Everybody knows about it. And usually about 90% think it's right. There actually have been many, many proposals of different ways to characterize styles of learning. The person who posted on Facebook has mentioned the most common, which is visual learners, auditory learners, kinesthetic learners. The long and short of it on research is this isn't very difficult research to do. It's pretty easy to test. All you would need to do is, just to make it simple, let's think about visual and auditory. You would have, say, a slideshow depicting a story. Then you would come up with an audio tape that tells the same story. And then you would categorize people as visual or auditory learners. Everybody experiences either the slideshow or the tape, and some people in their preferred modality, some in their non-preferred, and then later you test either their comprehension or their memory for the story. So a very straightforward way to test this. That's been done, and there just isn't any support for the idea that there are learning styles. How this came to be so popular is the second question people ask. Why is it so pervasive? And I do not know. It's easy to see why it's sort of self-perpetuating. It's sort of like if you ask me, you know, what's the evidence for atomic theory, Dan? I would say, I don't know. That's just like everybody knows it's right, right? It's just one of those things that they have figured out. And I think learning styles has become a little bit like that. You just hear about it and you figure it's probably right. But yeah, it's a great example of something that is commonly accepted about education for which there is no good data.
Cognitive psychologist Dr. Dan Willingham is our guest. His new book is titled, When Can You Trust the Experts? How to Tell Good Science from Bad in Education. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our call-in lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. You do get some heated response from teachers who use the learning styles theory in their classroom when you tell them the scientific evidence doesn't support what they're doing.
Yes. So the first time I gave a talk to teachers, I mentioned this just sort of in passing because I didn't know that it was so widely held. And I mean, it was sort of like torches and pitchforks. People were very, very angry at me. And what I've since realized is that the reason it's easy to see why teachers would be so angry, because it sounds like I'm saying if you use this, then you must be a bad teacher because you are doing something that is not proven. But of course, I'm not saying that at all. And this, again, gets at the relationship between science and practice. Lots of things go into teaching. So when someone tells me, look, you know, basically what I think they're saying is I use learning styles in my practice. It informs my practice. And I think I'm a good teacher. And my response is, I believe you when you say you're a good teacher, but there are probably many, many things going into your practice, your sensitivity to children, your own warmth, the way that you explain concepts to children, the experiences you give them, and so forth. So all of those things are making you a terrific teacher, and the learning styles business is probably not helping or not hurting. But what I always say is, look, I can tell you what is known about the mind from what goes on in the laboratory, and the classroom is that's your business.
Well, it may also be one of those cases where it's real difficult to separate out the theory from the practice, because if you're talking to somebody who says, I've made the effort to use this learning styles theory, and I separate my students into those I think learn better by touch, and those who learn better by hearing, and those who learn better by visual, there's a good chance you're talking to a teacher who puts a lot of effort and care and compassion into how she approaches or he approaches the children in their classroom, and that could very well be related to how well the kids learn.
That's a great point. Absolutely.
You have this fascinating formula in your book, Dan, When Can You Trust the Experts, that I think applies to much more than just research about education. I think it goes something like, if you do X, then there is Y percent chance that Z will occur. And if I've got that right, I suspect we can use that in all aspects of life. So I'm going to ask you to explain when we continue in a bit more than 1 minute. Dan Willingham has written extensively in the field of cognitive psychology, including books titled Cognition, Current Directions in Cognitive Science, Why Don't Students Like School, and his most recent book, When Can You Trust the Experts? He's also a regular contributor to American Educator magazine with his column, Ask the Cognitive Scientist. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Dom Graham. Tom Graham? Yeah, sometimes I can pronounce my name. Hey, let me get to this theory that I think I can pronounce. If I do X, then there is a Y percent chance that Z will occur.
Right. So this is a formulation that I offer in the book that it's really, it is sort of a little mnemonic. It's a way to try and remind ourselves that what you want to do first is be very clear about what the claim is. So when someone is trying to sell you a product, what they're really trying to do is get you to change something in yourself, or more often, change something in the behavior of the children who are in your charge. And so what I suggest is you want to know, you want to be very clear about what it is I am committing to if I do X, and then what is the outcome, and then what is the probability I'm actually going to get that outcome. And what you find when you do this is it's surprising how frequently either X, Y, or Z is relatively unclear to you. Y is frequently unspecified, right? There's just no statement at all about the probability that this is actually
going to
happen.
What the end result is going
to
be.
Y, which is the probability that you're going to get the end result. Frequently, you're sort of left to believe it's inevitable that this is going to happen. But, you know, it's not inevitable, right? I mean, the reading program may be very good, but that doesn't mean everybody, you know, shows the same benefit from it, right? So you'd really like to know what the probability is. And then the other thing is with Z, what the outcome is. Sometimes that can be quite vague. So you're told, you know, your child will greatly improve in reading. Well, how will I know when I see that? Will my child more frequently pick up a book on his or her own? Am I going to see her struggle less when she's reading aloud, and so forth? So I think it's very important to be clear on those things. That's one reason to do the if I do X, there's a Y percent chance that Z will happen. The other reason is I'm encouraging you to sort of get rid of a lot of what I call peripheral cues to belief. So if we think about central cues to belief as being good reason, you know, really substantial evidence that this thing is going to work, the peripheral cues are things that in your better moments you would recognize this is not something that should persuade me, but in your less than perfect moments could end up persuading you. So this is stuff that social psychologists have been looking at for the last 50 years, and there's a substantial literature on it. Things like we're more likely to believe people who are like us. So you'll frequently see advertisements on websites, for example, where the person who developed the product will say, look, I'm a parent just like you, right? And so what they're trying to appeal to is that I'm like you, I understand where you're coming from. Another peripheral cue is emotional appeals, where you try to the person who's persuading you will either try to make you sort of feel really hopeful. This is frequently the pitch to teachers because teachers are a pretty optimistic bunch. They love kids. And so one way you can really appeal to teachers is to give them the sense that if you use this product, that child who you've just been having a hard time connecting with, this is going to afford that connection. So you're offering this beautiful appeal of hope. And that's a nice feeling, but it doesn't tell you anything about the likelihood it's actually going to work. So in the book, I call this strip it. Strip the claim down to its bare essentials. Okay, let's get to brass tacks. If I do X, there's a Y percent chance that it will happen.
I don't know if I passed the television and there was a commercial on shortly after I first came across this formula in your book, and you come back to it numerous times, but it just struck me as such a beautiful example of something that you do in several instances in the book. Although you're aiming specifically at science and research about education, you've got so many strategies in there that apply to all different other areas of life. And so whenever I look at this formula now, what I'm saying in my mind is, okay, if I spend $50 to buy this face cream, there is a 20% chance that in the next 8 weeks, the brown spots on my face are going to go away.
Right. Yeah.
If I do X, then there's a Y percent chance that Z will occur.
There you go.
Try it. Put it into any sort of context. See how it works for you. Our phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. Our guest, cognitive psychologist Dan Willingham. Next to Lexington. Dawn, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
I'm interested in the comment you made about how easy it is to design an experiment to look at the difference between auditory versus visual learners. And then you also sort of included kinesthetic and how the learning styles really hasn't borne out scientifically. But my specific question is, you have people, whether they self-define as preferring to learn auditorily or visually, tend to have to learn with a pen or a pencil in their hand, so that regardless of how they're learning, they are either, you know, one subgroup might be doodling and the other might be actively taking notes on what it is that is coming into them, and that somehow that note-taking and or doodling helps reinforce for them the input. And is there any way to test for that, and would you consider that a way of kinesthetic learning?
Thanks, Dawn. So I guess the signature for learning styles would be that it is something that some people show and other people don't show. So what you would be proposing is that there's a subset of people for whom doodling or writing helps them process information, and that's true only for them, and it's true across situations. So those are the important features, and what gets confusing in the learning styles literature is people frequently think that there's evidence for learning styles that's really evidence for ability. In other words, someone is good at remembering auditory information. That's not a style. That's an ability. You're good at remembering auditory information, right?
Right.
So that's one thing that we don't want to make a mistake about. And the other is this business that it needs to be true only for a subset of people and for them consistently across situations, because something like note taking is probably going to help everybody. That's not really a style. That's just ensuring that people are paying attention to what's being said, finding ways to summarize it. That's going to help it sort of get cemented into memory. But that'll be true for everybody.
In my experience, there are some people who can sit, for instance, in a lecture, and they will actually attend better and process the concepts better if they are not taking notes simultaneously. And for others, the note-taking is an important part of the process of understanding, because somehow they are organizing the cognitive input, like in an outline, at the same time. And that seems to me to be a learning style type of issue, and I guess you're saying it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I would explain, first of all, I don't know if that's true, but it actually sounds plausible to me what you just said, but I would probably explain that via other mechanisms. So I would be thinking that the people who are benefiting from note-taking, first of all, they're probably more fluent writers, and so it's demanding less attention for them to write. And they also just may have a better knack for note-taking, meaning they're better at listening, coming up with a brief summary, and writing it down, whereas the other students who are struggling with it, maybe they haven't been instructed in effective ways of taking notes, and so they're trying to get down every word, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Dawn, thanks so much for your call.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Dawn.
The book is titled When Can You Trust the Experts? How to Tell Good Science from Bad in Education. Its author, University of Virginia Professor of Psychology, Dan Willingham, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Phone number 888-967-2825. Dan, in your book, you talk some about pendulum swings in education. Can you tell me about that and why you think they occur?
Yeah, so this is a sort of a common observation, especially among historians of education, which is that we have too short a memory in education policy. So the most frequently observed pendulum swing, I think, is sort of back to basics movements versus more progressive approaches to education. So, for example, we've just recently been going through a back to basics movement, and that's associated with the standards movement. And this typically is this rhetoric that goes with this. People say, like, you know, kids need to know the times table. Kids need to know some dates, you know, in history. And then what we start after about a decade of that, we start to get frustrated because we think, well, gosh, you know, they've got all these facts, but they don't really know how to think. No one's teaching them how to use those facts. And so then we get a more progressive approach where kids are doing more projects and they're going on more field trips. And then someone notices that, you know, high school sophomores can't date the Civil War to within a quarter of a century, and people get upset about that. This is relevant to research because research is really about, and one part of it is record keeping. It's keeping track of what has worked and what hasn't worked and letting that inform future policy. And that is something that American education could do a much better job of.
To you listening in, when are you most likely to believe a reported scientific finding, whether by the education or anything else? When are you least likely to believe one? 888-WMRA Talk is the phone number to call if you're willing to share your thoughts. That's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And this from Becky in response to a Facebook question about when do you believe and when do you not believe. She says, listen to see if the quote is based on one or more studies, who conducted them, and what organizations or special interests may have funded this so-called latest research.
Wow, yeah, so there's a lot there. And I mostly agree, but let me build on those suggestions. So I think looking at the research is a great idea. In the book, this is sort of the last step that I suggest. I start with the sort of strip it that we already talked about, and then I suggest some other things. And looking at the research is the last thing because it's very demanding of your time. Really looking at research and trying to even do a light version of looking at the published research is time consuming, you know. And so you want.
In addition to which, if you're not an expert in how statistics are put together or what types of research apply to what types of results, it can be that it's going to be very difficult. Even if you do go into dozens, if not 100 hours or more of reading the research studies, you may not know what you've come up with.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, if you really want to understand and digest research, I mean, you're in for a substantial time. I'm not even talking about that. And I say this, you know, not because I think that people aren't smart. People are smart, but it takes an enormous amount of time. I mean, once I get outside my very narrow specialty, I can't read the research literature with any intelligence at all. You know, any field of science outside of psychology, and I'm completely at a loss. So, as you say, there is specialized statistics and so on.
But so what Becky is saying here in her comment, and we got another one a few minutes ago from Catherine on our Facebook page, is basically follow the money.
Yeah, and I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, I think that I'm sympathetic to the fact that there are times when people will put a new product out there and they would like nothing better than for a bona fide scientist to evaluate it. But a bona fide scientist may not be interested. So if suppose, Tom, you and I create a new web product that's based on my knowledge of learning and your knowledge of radio, and we're going to teach people how to be fantastic radio personalities. And we really try and do a creditable job, and we think we've got a great product. Well, we may welcome scientists to come and evaluate it, but scientists are probably just not going to be interested. The only time they're going to get interested is if a whole lot of people are using it. That tends to be when education researchers say, okay, well, look, this is influencing a lot of people's lives. We ought to look into this. So that's why you and I, Tom, might consider, well, we've got a little bit of money here. Maybe we can fund some research and we'll try and get, you know, legitimate researchers to do it. So I'm sympathetic to what Becky is saying. You have to be suspicious when the funding is coming from someone with a vested interest. At the same time, there is this mitigating factor that as to why people might be motivated to do that.
So what you're saying is that there are times when, although the research may come from an interest that would benefit from the sale, it still could be good research.
It could be good research, absolutely.
Our guest on this edition of Virginia Insight is research psychologist Daniel Willingham. His new book is titled, When Can You Trust the Experts? Tell me how much, if at all, personal prejudice that I bring into hearing about some research is going to affect my response to it.
That it's an enormous challenge. It is going to influence the way you hear about it or the way you evaluate research. And in general, again, this is something social psychologists have been studying for something like 50 years now, is how we process information, how we remember information is strongly influenced by what we already believe. This sort of broad series of effects are generally called confirmation biases. We are biased to continue to believe what we already believe. And at first, it sounds sort of crazy, and it sounds very maladaptive. When you think about it, it's not quite as crazy and maladaptive as it first seems. You don't want every little thing that happens to you sort of knocking your whole belief system around. So if I can accommodate what happens into my current belief system, then it's easy to see why I might be motivated to do that.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I mean, one of the strong confirmation biases concerns the way that we seek out new information. And so there are very simple laboratory tests for how you do this. When you're seeking out new information, you will look for information that confirms your hypothesis rather than some that would prove your hypothesis wrong. So this was first shown in the early 60s with a task called the 2-4-6 task. So you tell a subject, there's a rule by which I have can generate a sequence of numbers. And I'll tell you now that one sequence that's consistent with the rule is 2-4-6. Now, what I want you to do is to try and figure out the rule, and to test it, I want you to tell me a sequence of numbers. And then I will say yes or no as to whether or not it conforms to the sequence that I have in mind, or the rule that I have in mind. So what people do is they'll come up with a hypothesis. For example, okay, he said 2-4-6. Well, maybe it's numbers that go up by 2. So now I've got a hypothesis, and I can try and look for information as to whether it's right or not. So I could say, all right, Tom, I think here's my guess. 8, 10, 12, expecting that you're going to say yes. But given my hypothesis, I could also say 8, 10, 11, expecting you to say no. That would be equally informative, right? People seldom do that. They have a hypothesis, and they go out looking for information that confirms their hypothesis rather than information that tells them that their hypothesis is wrong.
And that's an example of a confirmation bias.
Exactly.
Often we're engaging in this kind of behavior, this kind of filtering of information that comes toward us, and having no idea that we're doing it.
Exactly. So if I think that learning styles are part of the way people learn, I'm going to notice and remember instances that seem to confirm that idea.
You have this fascinating story at the beginning of Chapter 7 about something that spread across classrooms in Great Britain and a little bit here in the U.S. too, that I'm going to ask you about after we get Ian's call when we get back. Cognitive psychologist Dr. Daniel Willingham is our guest. His new book is titled, When Can You Trust the Experts? How to Tell Good Science from Bad in Education. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Beginning of Chapter 7, would you just read for us, Dan, those first couple of paragraphs and then the list that appears under it?
You bet. Let's pretend that it's 2005 and that you hear about Brain Gym. a program of physical movements that the website claims enhances learning and performance in all areas. The front page of the website from 2005 claims that the program is used in more than 80 countries and that the company has been in business for more than 30 years, so there seem to be plenty of people who find it valuable. The website headline tugs at both enlightenment and romantic heartstrings, which I went into earlier in the book. Brain Gym develops the brain's neural pathways the way nature does. Even though it's 2005, long before this book was published, let's suppose that you strip the claims here. The core idea is that students who perform 26 relatively simple exercises will observe dramatic academic improvements. The promises on the web homepage are that the exercises enable one to, first, learn anything faster and more easily, second, perform better at sports, third, be more organized and focused, fourth, start and finish projects with ease, fifth, overcome learning challenges, and sixth, reach new levels of excellence.
So this is something called Brain Gym.
Gym, G-Y-M, right.
An educational product that sort of swept the landscape in public schools in Great Britain based on the notion that if you get kids in their classroom to do certain kinds of movements at different times of day, and some of these are very specific sort of
very specific
weird
yes.
movements.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there one about touching your...
Yeah, you touch your abdomen and sort of rub your collarbone or something like that. And this was called brain buttons. It was supposed to stimulate your left hemisphere.
So this wasn't just a matter of getting some exercise.
Exactly. Yeah, that was... It sounded much more technical than like, oh, it would be a really good idea for kids to get up and stretch every once in a while, right? It was not that, yeah.
And what happened in Great Britain with this program?
So it was surprising how successful it was, and it seemed to have sort of...
Successful in terms of getting used.
In terms of penetration in classrooms, right. So lots and lots of classrooms and schools adopting it and really buying in and feeling that it was working well and doing kids a lot of good. And more remarkably, it had this what seemed to be sort of a semi-official blessing from the British government. So there was lots of information on Brain Gym about on the British government's website about Brain Gym. So yeah, it was fantastically successful. The cover really got blown off in 2006. So it was a reason the segment of the book I was saying, imagine it's 2005. It really got blown up in 2006. There's a columnist for a British newspaper, and the columnist's name is Ben Goldacre. And he writes an ongoing column called Bad Science. And he said there's absolutely no scientific backing for Brain Gym at all, and yet the British government has bought into it. This attracted a lot of attention in two learned societies in Britain, one of physiologists and one of neuroscientists, sent a letter to every single school district in Great Britain saying, look, we're here to tell you there's nothing to this. And it also... The sort of physiology that's described here is wrong, and it's just there's no way this works the way it's described. So it's sort of I offer it as a case study.
But it took years to get it out of some British schools.
And it's still in some American schools, amazingly enough. I think most school districts are really onto it by now because the blow up was so public. But what I find so interesting, and the reason I offer it, is that if you were looking at their website in 2005, here's the question I pose for you. How would you have known that it was not legitimate? After 2006, when it attracted all this scientific attention, it was easy to know. In 2005, if you went to the website, it did not look bad. So there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about it, and that, of course, was posted on the website. And the story was sort of neutral. It wasn't a big boost, but here it is in a very legitimate newspaper. They had listings of scientific studies, what they claimed were scientific studies showing that this worked. So how would you have seen through their smokescreen? That's the challenge to
raise. One of the things that you point out in the book is that if you were knowledgeable enough to specialized enough in knowledge to know where to go find those studies and to read the complete study and understand it, you would see that most of those studies at best sort of only peripherally touched upon anything that Brain Gym claimed to be doing and certainly did not prove that Brain Gym's approach was efficacious.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a very common Dodge. So they want to have studies up there. And it's sort of like the mere presence of studies is enough. And they're banking on the idea that you won't go look at them at all. And you usually don't even need to read the whole thing. If you just read the summary abstract at the front end, that's frequently enough. But there are two Dodges. One that BrainGym used was they were testing BrainGym, but the outcome measures were things that you wouldn't care about. It was like button pressing and, you know, like how quickly you could press buttons in response to lights, not whether or not you were, you know, learning how to read better. The other thing that's even more common is they will refer to legitimate scientific articles that are sort of peripherally related to what the product is, but they don't really evaluate the product. So there's a website that focuses on the cerebellum, a very large structure in the back of the brain, as a source of autism. And then it has all the listings of all of these studies when, you know, it has a little section of the website here, research. And you go look at that, and there are all these studies in terrific journals, and there is all this stuff about the cerebellum and autism, but it has nothing to do with evaluating the actual product.
So we talked a little bit before about the formula that you offer to sort of strip the claims that the if I do X, then there is a Y percent chance that Z will occur, to get down to what the very basic sales pitch is and what I'm supposed to get out of it, how much of a chance there is that I'll get it. But is there another part of your answer to that question? If you saw this website promise in 2005, before the scientific community started lambasting it, how would you know that it wasn't worthwhile?
Well, I think this is, if you've come this far and you've gotten interested enough and you're really thinking seriously about adopting this, buying BrainGym or whatever it is, obviously we're talking about something that is going to be a big investment. If it is really like, you know, a $5 bottle of face cream, maybe you just buy it and see whether or not it works. But if you're contemplating something that's going to be a lot of your time and a lot of your child's time, it may really be worth trying to dig into the research literature a little bit. And so in the book, I go through, I suggest the techniques of both how to find this stuff and then how to evaluate it. My expectation is you're not going to want to try and read every single article. Frequently, you can't get access to all of them, and they're very, very expensive to actually buy them from publishers. But one thing you can do that is socially acceptable is to email the authors and ask them to send you a copy, and usually they will. And again, you can usually get a lot just from reading the summary. And the key things to look for, I think it was Becky who posted this on Facebook, one is to look at whether or not the journal was peer-reviewed. And you hear about this a lot, and I do think that that's important, because what it means is somebody who does have some experience in whatever this topic is has looked at it and thought that it met some minimal standard. Doesn't mean that everything that's published in a peer-reviewed journal is fantastic science, but it's certainly a start. It's an indicator that this is probably legitimate science.
And you beat me to it. Actually, Joni also made that point about seeing if you can find peer-reviewed journals that have published a reputable study, or if it seems reputable by being published in a peer-reviewed journal. So Becky and Joni, thank you both for that. This is from Ian now on Facebook, Dr. Dan Willing. Ian says, there exists enormous differences in the way people observe or remember as witnesses of an identical experience. Could Dr. Willingham make a distinction between an argument for the existence of a common learning style and the very different ways people remember past events?
Yeah, I think if I'm understanding the question, Ian's question, I think the reason that people remember events differently, I wouldn't say is attributable to a style. Again, if it were a style, we would expect that it would be, we would see some persistent sign of it across different experiences. People are going to remember different things from the same experience because they're likely to notice different things that are happening in some complex event. There are lots of things that you might notice, and different people will notice different things because of the peculiarities of where their attention is directed, probably as a function of stuff that they already know, experiences they've had in the past. So I think you could still think that the sort of core processes of learning are pretty similar, but they're being influenced by things that you already know, which we know affects learning and memory, and then also how attention is directed.
Tell me some about cognitive dissonance and how that plays into what we believe and what we don't.
Oh, yeah. We were talking earlier about sort of motivated reasoning, reasons that you would believe something other than your own desire to get at the truth. And again, I don't want to make it seem like we're just buffeted about and we're completely irrational creatures. We're not. We want to know what, you know, as best we can, what is really true out there in the world. But we do have these other factors that influence us, and cognitive dissonance is one of them. So dissonance is, generally speaking, the motivation for your thoughts to sort of be in harmony. And if you hold conflicting beliefs, you are motivated to change one of those beliefs so that they no longer conflict. So this is especially a problem in when we're talking about educational products, because if I invest my time and invest my money, and especially if I'm, you know, enrolled my children in whatever this educational treatment is, that's a big investment, right? That's cost me a lot. That's cost my child something. Now suppose I'm drawing the conclusion that this isn't really helping. This thing I'm doing is not doing my child any good. Well, those are conflicting thoughts, right? On the one hand, I've made a big investment. On the other hand, if this investment was absolutely worthless, those are conflicting thoughts, and I'm going to be motivated to try and change one of them. It's hard for me to now deny that, no, I haven't. I didn't spend $600 on this thing. It's easier for me to change the thought that that it hasn't helped, right? So I'll be sort of clutching at straws and looking for some way that I can say, all right, admittedly, you know, my child still says that she hates math, but I think maybe she hates it a little less than she used to. Or, you know, she did get a 65 instead of a 60 on that last quiz or whatever it is. So that's how cognitive dissonance plays into this.
And psychological researchers such as yourself tell us, as much as we hate to believe it, cognitive dissonance occurs almost all the time for all of us, that when there are two separate poles to what we should believe, we want to believe the thing that keeps us looking best.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, all of us are susceptible to this to greater or lesser degrees all the time. And it applies to scientists as well. I mean, scientists are have to be on their guard for motivated cognition. It affects how we interpret our own studies, right? So you think about cognitive dissonance. I work on a study for a year and it's really kind of a flop. Well, I'm not going to take that lying down if I can help it, right? I'm going to be combing through the data trying to find something to salvage it, because I don't want to admit to myself this was all a big waste of time. So this is a lot of what science is about, and the way that we do science is exactly to try as best we can to keep ourselves honest so that we are, and I say late in the book, we frequently think of the point of science as objectivity, but objectivity is really in service of another goal, and that's elasticity of mind. The point of science is to try to make you as open as possible to changing your mind, recognizing you've been thinking about things wrong, and follow the data when it tells you there's a better way to think about things.
And you say that another aspect of science that's related to what you're just talking about is, you never believe that you have absolute truth, that you have to approach it with the idea that somebody at some point is going to improve on it further?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that has been the history of science. And this was when the scientific method was first developed in the 17th century, approximately. That was not the view. People felt that it was a very religious view of science. People really felt that nature was this enormous, beautiful, orderly book on which God had written. And there was one set of rules by which the universe worked. And humans, with their ingenuity, could uncover what those rules were. It was tremendously exciting at the time. But it was very much a view of science as sort of static. Once, and people literally said this, Newton figured out how the heavens worked. That was it. It was done. And that's not how we view it anymore. Now we recognize We're constantly refining our knowledge and coming to deeper and deeper understandings. It very seldom happens when you have something that's really, really well established, like Newtonian mechanics, that we just throw it out the window. We say, we see how this is mostly a good description of what's going on, but there are some circumstances under which it doesn't make the right predictions, and now we have a deeper understanding of why that is.
We're just about out of time, Dan, but I want to ask you briefly in the 30 seconds or so we have left to address the fact that in your book you make a case for creating some sort of authoritative body that could be relied upon to gauge the worthiness of education research. Tell me a little about that.
I think that would be a tremendous resource if we had it. And this is how we opened. When I said I wrote the book exactly because we don't have that. We have that in other fields. We have reliable institutions to which physicians, for example, can turn and know what is the status of the science on a particular controversy. And it's not up to the individual physician to comb through the literature and figure it out on their own. If we had a resource like that for teachers and parents, I think it would be a fantastic asset.
Our guest has been Dr. Dan Willingham, writer of several texts on cognitive psychology, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, and author of the new book, When Can You Trust the Experts? How to Tell Good Science from Bad in Education. Dan, thanks so very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Sal.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producer is Bob Levicky and Terry Ward. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Tony Field, Elliot Majerzik, and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Dr. Willingham is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.